BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcast. This is Year of the Iggy, a podcast series that tells the story of Iggy Pop over the course of a year. My name is Andy, and I'll be your host throughout this audio journey. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I'd encourage you to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Iggy. Also, remember to rate, like, and share the podcast with others that might enjoy it. On this month's episode, Iggy Pop defines his own solo sound. In the spring of 1976, Iggy Pop found himself in France, continuing the process of rehabilitation while David Bowie worked on his latest album, Low. Their month at Chateau Studios had not gone great, and the somber tone of the sessions made Iggy anxious and nervous that he might slip up on his sobriety. Feeling the need for a change, Bowie suggested they return to LA and finish up the album. Iggy reminded Bowie of how relaxed and pedestrian their lives had been a month earlier while mastering his first solo album, The Idiot, in Germany. Soon after, the duo returned to Berlin for an extended stay. Here's producer Tony Visconti discussing their new living conditions in Germany.
By the time we went to Berlin for Heroes, David had this enormous apartment, which was dirt cheap, and Iggy had his own side of the apartment, and David had his own side, and they had about five pieces of furniture in that studio, and they couldn't have been happier. They loved living that life for a change, you know. Yeah. David had, prior to that, lived in a millionaire's paradise, you know, luxury buildings and all that.
Living in Berlin brought a much-needed change to Bowie's mood, and soon the two became immersed in the German culture.
And they were wearing ragged German clothes, like they looked like German working class. They had the scarf, and they had cigarettes hanging out of their mouths, and Andy cap, cloth cap.
Those hats, yeah.
Yeah, And they walked through Berlin unnoticed. You wouldn't know that was David Bowie and Iggy Pop walking down the street. You know, they would pass. Also, they go into a bar and they go, they'd say in simple German, "Ein Bier bitte." And the German person wouldn't know that they were not German.
Right.
You get into a lowbrow bar, that this bartender's not going to talk to you in German. You know, he's not going to talk to you at all. He just takes your money and gives you a
exactly.
Beer. I know. So it was really fun for them to like live this other lifestyle and enjoy every minute of it.
The change of environment also ignited a creative spark in the both of them. While Bowie feverishly worked on material for Low, an album that Pitchfork.com would name the best album of the 70s, Iggy began expressing himself through poetry.
I was living with him, and I would write these poems about the misery and angst I was going through as basically a Ronin. You know, I'd had a band that had gone to hell. I had a home that had vanished. I had a culture that was gone. And here I was out there.
Bowie also encouraged Iggy to explore other creative outlets, with painting becoming a major activity in their apartment. Here's Bowie discussing a painting he did of Iggy Pop during their time in Berlin.
Well, I had a way of working through musical problems by painting them out at one time, and that seems to have disappeared over the years. But
you've lost that ability.
Yeah. For one reason or another, that seems to have changed now.
All right, let's take a look at some of them, and then we'll come back. What's that? Could this be Iggy Pop, huh?
It certainly could be Iggy Pop. That's Iggy Pop in 1976, as I saw him when. We were living in Berlin. We just moved. We both had fairly severe drug problems. And so to rectify that, we moved to Berlin, the heroin capital of the world, which I guess in retrospect doesn't sound like a terribly sensible
thing. No, it doesn't sound very smart to me.
And that's a picture of Jim turning blue in his apartment in Berlin.
As mentioned in that clip, Berlin was certainly not devoid of drugs. And the two did continue to dabble on occasion, although they had a system for working through their recovery.
Typical day, it would work like this. If a week has 7 days, and out of the 7 days, there would still be, for old times' sake, 2 binge days. Then the next 2 days after that were recovery days. But that leaves 3 days a week to do normal things, which is a lot for a musician.
Eventually, Bowie would complete production on the album Low and release it in January of 1977. with the release date for Iggy's first solo album, The Idiot, coming months later, Bowie began using his connections to land Iggy tour dates for a 2-month world tour. Between recording sessions, Bowie would join Iggy and his touring band in the rehearsal studio, and by the time the band was ready to hit the road, Bowie decided he'd like to join, not as a headliner, but as Iggy's keyboard player. Here's the mega rock star discussing his decision to play backup band for the lesser-known Iggy Pop.
I've never enjoyed a tour as much as I'm enjoying this one, just playing keyboards, because I think it's as fulfilling as any of my tours.
What an interesting thing, because I noticed that a lot of the rock artists will play as sidemen on a temporary day, a basis, on a recording session. Mm. With other performers, but I have never seen them do it to this extent. But what happens with your career?
Oh, that's fine. I am very rich, you know.
Yeah.
I can afford it. And well, I guess if you're willing to, you know, just wait out, and I don't see the necessity of doing a tour of my own until I want to do one.
Yes.
Not for the bucks. I'd much prefer to do one because I want to do a tour. Then I prefer to do something that really excites me, and playing piano behind Iggy Pop for me is very exciting.
Well, see, now that's wonderful. Just, you know.
As mentioned in that clip, Bowie absolutely loved touring with Iggy Pop. It also helped ticket sales, with many fans coming simply to view the arena star in a smaller venue. Here's a clip from one of their performances where Bowie's distinctive voice can be heard singing backup. Midway through the tour, Iggy returned to Michigan for 2 nights in Detroit. After contacting his son a year earlier via a handwritten letter, Iggy called and invited Eric to attend one of his shows. Here's Eric reflecting on that magical night backstage.
Just noticing all the attention that people paid to him, you know, it's for a little kid to see that, I think it was a pretty big impact. And, you know, just spending some time with him backstage and getting to know him, I guess, you know.
And I was happy to see him, and it was nice, it was moving. I think it was one of those moments where he was looking at me, I was looking at him. It's kind of like, oh, you know.
Even though Iggy had to leave the next day to continue his tour, he promised his son he'd work toward being a better father and keep the communication lines open. As the tour continued, Bowie landed Iggy multiple appearances on national talk shows to help promote both the tour and the new album. For the Dinah Shore show, Bowie even joined Iggy on the interview couch as the host attempted to make sense of these strange, strange men in her studio.
And Iggy Pop and David Bowie. You've known each other for years, haven't you?
Yeah, for 6 years.
David, you recorded Iggy first, or Jimmy first.
No. Iggy already had 2 albums out on his own that he'd done himself.
I see.
And then the general favor went against Jim because of what he was doing at the time. But
would you describe some of the things you were doing at the time? You were doing things to yourself physically that were...
Yeah, and to other people, too.
Why?
Because I was bored
and angry, and when I couldn't, you know, when things would get so... When something that demanded action every day would keep pestering my mind and I couldn't do anything about it, finally sometimes I would give up and just resort to simple violence.
On yourself, though, mostly?
Usually on myself, because I hated to do it, take it out on other people. I thought that was wrong.
That's considerate.
Yeah. I thought I was being more considerate.
Yeah.
So often I would do to myself what I wanted to do to someone else.
I mean, like, for instance, you poured hot wax on yourself once.
Yes, but that, you see, that didn't hurt.
It didn't hurt.
No, it doesn't. It just...
And
I didn't know at the time that it wouldn't hurt, though.
But you cut yourself with a bottle.
Yeah, well, that was because I'd done something really foolish the night before, and I was ashamed.
And you took it out.
I left. Yeah.
When you saw Iggy perform, what was your
reaction?
Never
saw Iggy perform. I just heard the albums. And then I must admit somebody played me a videotape of a performance that he did with his original band, The Stooges. Mm. And I didn't like it very much because then I saw the violence. And it's not what I heard from the lyrics.
Because your music, when you have a lovely, as you say, sound way up
I'm
here.
I'm a cyborg. My stuff is very different. Mine comes from sort of up to from right. there, yeah. And Jimmy's comes from about here down to about there. You know.
I don't know. I wonder what he means by that.
Gee whiz.
I don't know. I'll ask you later.
Okay, kid. I'll tell you.
Not all of Iggy's talk show appearances would be as congenial and fun as his time spent with Dinah Shore. During an interview on the CBC, Iggy became defensive when host Peter Kazowski questioned his art.
What sounds to you like a big load of trashy old noise is in fact the brilliant music of a genius, myself. And that music is so powerful that it's quite beyond my control. And when I'm in the grips of it, I don't feel pleasure and I don't feel pain.
Things would escalate when the host asked Iggy about the hot new music craze known as punk rock. Iggy took exception to the question.
Tell me about punk rock, because I have heard, I've read all kinds of reviews.
Well, I'll tell you about punk rock. Punk rock is a word used by dilettantes.
Okay.
And heartless manipulators. About music that takes up the energies and the bodies and the hearts and the souls and the time and the minds of young men who give what they have to it. It's a term that's based on contempt. It's a term that's based in fashion, style, elitism, Satanism, and everything that's rotten about rock and roll.
What I can't figure is whether you're acting against that label. You don't like the label.
I'm not acting.
No, I know. Reacting against the label then. Responding angrily to the label. You don't like the label. Is that right?
I don't like to hear it come out of someone's mouth.
Okay. Where do you like to hear it come out of?
While Iggy didn't like the label punk being put on the brash brand of music coming from the underground, he did take pride in the influence he and the Stooges had had on the burgeoning sound. The new genre's rising popularity also didn't hurt record and ticket sales, with many fans clamoring to see and hear the legendary performer. Realizing that the young punk rockers may not take to his newer, more experimental sound, Iggy also released an album that same year of the Stooges' last chaotic performance, entitled Metallic K.O. Once again, young punk rockers were inspired by Iggy and his music on the Idiot Tour, but in a much different way. Aspiring punk rocker Ian Curtis, who would go on to form the post-punk band Joy Division, caught a show in England and was blown away by pop's artistic expression. Members of the art rock band Magazine also took inspiration from the concert, leading them into a new, edgier direction. And Kevin Haskins, the drummer for the influential goth band Bauhaus, was enamored by the dark, brooding nature of Iggy's new material. Once again, Iggy Pop was helping point young musicians toward the future of music. During the tour, Iggy and Bowie continued writing new material. One afternoon, while taking a long ride in a tour bus, Iggy penned the lyrics to one of his most well-known solo tracks, The Passenger. Here he is discussing the inspiration behind the song.
There was part of a poem by Jim Morrison. He basically said, modern life is a journey by car. And he basically says that nobody can really get out of their own car, that it's very difficult, but once in a while, you can roll down the window and kind of try to change cars, but you can't really get out of the bloody car.
Oh, the passenger, how he rides. Oh, the passenger, he rides and he rides. He looks through his window, what does he see? He sees a silent and hollow sky. He sees the stars come out tonight. He sees the city's ripped back sides. He sees the winding ocean drive. And everything was made for you and me. All of it was made for you and me. But it just belongs to you and me. So let's take a ride and see what's mine.
By the time the tour ended, Iggy had enough new material to record another album. So, the duo returned to Berlin and began working on his next solo venture. While he was proud of The Idiot, he wanted his next album to sound a little less like Bowie and a little more like Iggy Pop. To help create more separation in the songwriting process, Iggy moved out of Bowie's apartment and got his own place. Here's Bowie talking about Iggy finding his voice on Lust for Life.
I think there was probably a little bit too much of me than was necessary on Idiot, but I think that was more because Iggy was still feeling his way again after a considerable absence from things. But I would tend to disagree. I think Lust for Life is far more like the old Iggy than anything he's done for a long time. And he really is very much his own boss, you know. I think that he's been able to shake my phantom off fairly quickly, considering.
Once again, Bowie was amazed by Iggy's ability to improvise lyrics on the spot.
In the studio, Jimmy would make up the lyrics on the spot, and we would keep everything that he did, and occasionally change a line after we recorded. But Jimmy, I've never seen anybody be able to make up lyrics so fast, just out of his head to a track. A very spontaneous kind of lyric. It's not like a written thing at all with Jimmy.
While the majority of the sophomore album was Iggy Pop personified, the most well-known track was actually inspired by late-night German television and David Bowie's ukulele.
We were in his apartment in Berlin, and we were going to watch. We had one television show a week in English that came on. It came on the Armed Forces Network. And the American forces had a logo. Like other brands do. It was a cartoon of a radio tower, and the tower went beep 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 with concentric circles like this. Beep 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 beep. And he just picked up a ukulele and he said, record this. And he just started playing the changes. I went through the changes and he said, I recorded it on a Philips mono tape recorder, $25 tape recorder. And then he said, call that Lust for Life.
Yeah.
Iggy and his studio band completed the entire album in just 8 days, and many of those involved with the project have compared the process to a religious experience. Guitarist Carlos Alomar said of the sessions, quote, "Seeing the two of them in partnership was just like when you split an atom and you get a pair of twins."
I think that over time there was a really good exchange for everybody. And to be honest, when I met David, I'd been performing as Iggy for 4 years. Iggy wasn't going to get anywhere without a shift. And I think it was with his help that I was able to keep going. Yeah. So, you know, who took what or who did what is not as important as was everyone useful and fulfilled.
Everyone involved with the project kept reassuring Iggy that this was going to be the album that made him a household name. And even RCA Records liked what they heard from the early raw cuts. Then, everything changed on August 6th, 1977.
Good evening. Elvis Presley died today. He was 42. Apparently, it was a heart attack. He was found at his home in Memphis, not breathing. His road manager tried to revive him. He failed. A hospital tried to revive him. It failed. His doctor pronounced him dead at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Now, you're probably wondering, what does the death of Elvis Presley have to do with Iggy Pop? Well, Lust for Life was scheduled for release on September 7th. But with the sudden demand for all things Elvis, the studio focused the majority of their funds towards repressing all of Elvis Presley's catalog. As a result, the album was barely promoted by the label, and once the initial pressings of the album were sold, there was no stock to replace it, with all of the pressing plants focusing energy on Elvis Presley. Bass player Tony Sales says of the label's failure to make Lust for Life a hit, quote, "Lust for Life just disappeared from the shelves, and that was it." Critics once again loved Iggy's solo work, but their kind words didn't mean squat when people couldn't even find the album at their local record store. Iggy decided his only option was to bring the music to the people, spending the next 8 weeks playing 40 shows around the globe.
The other day, she was a girl from Britain living in Denmark, and I said, "Camille, look at that beautiful Rolls Royce." And she said, "Jimmy, I hate fucking cars." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because I ain't got no money, and if I can't afford it, I hate it. And I see pinheads with Cadillacs. I see my girl, she's not coming back. When I see my life drifting by, and I know I'm gonna die. And I know I'm gonna die. So before I die, I'm gonna let you remember. See all this shit that's going down. This is what I say.
Concert reviews from across the land raved about the band's performances, and bandmates found Iggy to be professional and focused throughout the tour. Many of the articles began referring to Iggy as the godfather of punk, a moniker that Iggy thought may spike album sales amidst the rise of the new genre. Hoping that the band's hard work had paid off, he contacted his accountant to check in on the funds. Album sales and live receipts added up to $97,000, which might sound great, but his expenses for the tour and the album production added up to $103,000. So yeah, not great.
That's another thing, that people looking at your name and what you did would assume that the money was pouring in, but in fact you were properly old-fashioned broke for long stretches.
Hell yeah, old-fashioned broke, right on. Sure was. Forever and ever and ever.
Meanwhile, David Bowie was riding high on another successful album, In Heroes. While Iggy was happy for his friend, he also couldn't help but feel a bit bitter and frustrated. In Iggy's mind, he'd created a superior album. Despite his hard feelings, the two would remain friends for years to come, but their 2 years of touring and collaboration would come to an end.
We'd had enough of each other. It's like, I don't like the way you smoke your cigarette anymore. More like that, you know. I don't like your hair. Oh, yeah? Well, I don't like your shirt. Oh, yeah? Well, I don't like your girlfriend. Oh, yeah? Well, I don't like your mother. You know, it's like silly shit.
Iggy reached out to RCA Records, trying to get them to give his album a promotional push, but they wouldn't budge. While other major labels were jumping on the punk rock explosion, RCA didn't make any attempts to capitalize on Iggy's godfather status in the genre. With one album remaining on his RCA contract, Iggy made the rash decision to release a live album from his tour. This allowed him to be done with RCA, and it was also a cheap album to make. In an interview about the album, TVI Live, Iggy joked that the album cost $5,000 to make and profited $90,000. While this is certainly an exaggeration, the live album did help buoy his earnings after the disappointment of Lust for Life. After a European tour to support TVI Live, Iggy returned to his apartment in Hinterhof, Germany, and his girlfriend at the time, Esther, joined him for a period of time that was strangely domesticated. The lovebirds spent their days cooking together, going on walks through the park, and attending Sunday brunches with friends like German sculptor Martin Klippenberger. He also continued working on new music, playing guitar along with the Rolling Stones' latest effort, Some Girls. As Iggy and Esther lived the picket fence life in Germany, his new manager, Peter Davies, was working to land him a new label. Arista Records A&R man Charles Levison showed great interest in signing him, but label head Clive Davis still remembered his past run-in with a drunk Iggy Pop back in 1971, and he had no interest in signing a non-commercial act. Eventually, Davis agreed on the terms that this was Levison's pet project and that he didn't want anything to do with it. Levison reached out to Scott Thurston, who had worked on the Kill City project with Iggy years earlier, and booked him a flight to Germany to begin hashing out new material. The two of them gelled instantly, and before their week together was even over, they had a handful of new songs fleshed out, including the rambunctious ditty, 5 Foot One.
I'm only 5 foot one. I got a pain in my neck. I'm looking up in the city. What the hell? What the heck? I stare at the concrete. The girders rise high. The steel's above me. There's love in my eyes. And I'm doing the things 5 foot one man.
Back in Los Angeles, Iggy and Davies were joined in studio by drummer Klaus Kruger, bassist Jackie Clark, and former Stooges guitarist James Williamson, who also would produce the album. With Williamson came the partying life that Iggy had been trying to avoid, but he kept his narcotic intake limited to cocaine. The band's nightly partying didn't impact sessions, and the album entitled New Values was finished within weeks. While most of the album features the brash rock attitude that had defined most of Iggy's career, The synth-soaked melodies of the song Endless Sea show the continued influence of David Bowie on Iggy's evolution as an artist. Decades later, the odd little track would be covered by artists like Cat Power and The Church.
Oh, baby, what a place to be. In the service of the bourgeoisie. Where can my believers be? I want to jump into the endless sea. Oh, the endless sea. Sea. I want to jump into the endless sea. Let it wash all over me.
New Values was released in the UK in April of 1979, but the album didn't see store shelves in the United States until the fall. This delay was due in large part to Clive Davis, who felt the label needed to focus on spring releases by Whitney Houston and Barry Manilow. RCA Records had treated Iggy pretty badly, and now Arista Records was also doing him wrong. Coincidentally, the album reached number 60 on the UK charts, but only 180 in the States. Iggy was disappointed by the sales, knowing that the album was a quality collection of songs.
New Values, it was my first album going completely solo after I'd worked with Bowie. And, you know, I had never been comfortable. It took me years, 15 years, to be comfortable as a solo because I had been in a band and I missed that. And I missed it doing this album, but I worked hard on the songwriting and I think the songwriting is good and it's a careful little album. It's recorded and played simply, and it's re-released now. I'm happy about it. Look, it's a guy looking for some new values, trying to figure out, you know, a guy in his early 30s trying to figure out, gee, well,
I'm bored. I'm a sad man.
Yeah, what do I stand for? What's of use to me in the world? And getting no answers.
Critically, the album received lukewarm reviews, with many commenting on the generic production value that was due in large part to James Williamson's insistence on adding horn flourishes to many of the tracks. Arista A&R man Ben Edmonds said of the album, quote, James Williamson was a good producer, but he mixed the songs on that album like he was mixing cardboard. Once again, Iggy decided that if the label wasn't going to promote his work, he'd have to hit the road and do it himself. After cutting ties with the Sales Brothers, Iggy reached out to ex-Sex Pistols guitarist Glenn Matlock, feeling that the OG punk rocker might be able to bring that raw energy Williamson's production had sucked out of the New Values project. Here's Matlock recalling the phone call from Iggy Pop.
And I was sitting at home thinking, well, what am I going to do now? Wouldn't it be great if the phone rang? And it rang. And this guy said, is Glenn Matlock there? And I said, yeah, who are you? And he said, well, my name's Peter Davis. You won't know me, but I manage Iggy Pop, and we're here in London, and Jim would like a word with you. And I said, oh, hi. He said, well, we're in town, you know. Do you fancy a drink? And I said, who's buying? He said, we are. So I went and met him at this Flash Hotel. The next thing, I'm playing with Iggy Pop.
Soon after, Matlock joined Iggy, Jackie Clark, and Klaus Kruger on a 29-date tour. With the Arista Record PR team dropping the ball, Iggy had to do the promotional work himself, visiting radio stations, scheduling TV appearances, and contacting promoters around the world. Needless to say, the entire process annoyed him.
I say do it yourself. It's just down to that. I always wanted to do it myself. I always wanted to do it myself. Had I not succeeded in getting on the radio with New Values, then what that would mean to me, because I'm engaged in industrial art, would mean I wouldn't have the exposure necessary to book a tour like this in America. It's my money. It's not the record. I'm not supported on this by the record company. This was my idea. They didn't want me to come, actually.
To help promote record sales while on the road, Iggy began appearing at local record stores to sign LPs and meet young punk rock fans who grew up on his music. The label may not have appreciated him, but the fans certainly did. Here are some interviews of fans in line at one of these meet and greets.
He gets your anxieties out, you know. Him doing all that stuff makes you feel good, you know. Then you leave nice and relaxed.
It's the music. It's more than just the music. It's you have to see the music when it's live because the show is a big part of it. I mean, it's like an experience.
He's just great. He's pure rock and roll. He's real expressive, his vocals, and his lyrics. He's just one of the greatest. I just don't think he's been given the recognition that he should as a rock and roll star.
While on the road, Iggy worked closely with Glenn Matlock on new material. His hope was to inspire the guitars to write an Iggy Pop hit that had the same energy as some of Matlock's best work with the Sex Pistols. Once the tour finished, Arista Records booked them time at a small studio in Wales. A new A&R man, Tarquin Gotch, had taken the reins at the label, which did not bode well for Iggy. While the former A&R team was excited to have Iggy on board, Gotch didn't quite get the allure. He said of the relationship, quote, "We simply never had a proper conversation or a proper relationship." With support at Arista Records continuing to wane, Iggy knew this might be his last chance to strike it hot, and he decided that he'd pull out all the stops to have a mainstream hit. He had no reservations when the label suggested he try to emulate the latest craze in music, known as New Wave. To help capture the new wave sound, Iggy brought in a plethora of guests for the project, including members of the band Simple Minds, Barry Andrews, who was the keyboardist for the band Ecstasy, and of course the man who helped popularize synthesized music, David Bowie. Iggy invited Bowie to simply raise spirits in the studio, but several events would cause a ripple effect. That night, as they all sat around sipping wine, Bowie regaled them with outlandish tales, including several stories about a gangster by the name of Johnny Bindon. One tale told of the legendary size of Bindon's penis and how Princess Margaret, sister to Queen Elizabeth, often invited him up to Buckingham Palace for a nightcap. As the story continued, the musicians began joking about how fun life would be as a criminal. Iggy began improvising lyrics on the spot, singing, "I wish I was Johnny Bindon with the biggest fucking dick in London and a private income." Bowie loved it and ushered the band into the studio to try writing a song on the spot. The young musicians were enthused to be a part of the famous Bowie-Iggy creative team, and the song "I Need More" emerged from that late night session. One person who was not amused by the lewd lyrics was producer James Williamson, who had been directed by the label to create an album for the mainstream. Midway through recording, Williamson interrupted the song and announced, "Why don't you save this song for your dining room, Jim?" Well, Iggy didn't take kindly to Williamson's suggestion that the song wasn't good enough, and he responded, "Fuck you and your dining room, James. I don't think you belong on this project anymore."
Mama told me if I was goody that she would buy me a rubber dolly.
The next day, both Bowie and Williamson were gone. In need of a producer before the project imploded, the label wrangled up a local guy in Wales by the name of Pat Moran to try and salvage the project. The result is Soldier, a fun but messy-sounding album that doesn't resemble anything called New Wave. The album Soldier was far from the success Iggy was striving for, reaching only 62 on the UK charts and 125 in the US. Critics were kind to the album in a "this guy's a legend, but this album's not very good" kind of way, describing it as quirky and interesting. Keyboardist Barry Andrews, who had been thrilled to be a part of the project, was more than disappointed when he finally heard it. Years later, when friends and acquaintances asked which Iggy album he'd been featured on, he'd answer, the one that came out after all the good ones. On his past solo albums, Iggy had latched on to the DIY ethos by using his tour to promote the album himself. But for the Soldier tour, this attitude had all but vanished. Guitarist Rod Dupree would later describe the tour as, quote, "I realized pretty quickly that at that point, Iggy was just surviving. Toward the end of the tour, things got pretty grim."
They call me Mr. Dynamite. I blow things up in black and white. An end to your charade. A button I have made must be pushed.
Iggy Pop returns to his self-destructive habits on the next Year of the Iggy.
There is no reason for the sky. When I'm on fire from your lies. So if I win this fight, they'll call me Mr. Dynamite.
If you enjoyed today's episode and don't want to wait another month for the next installment, go check out the other seasons of the Year of the Podcast series. For the David Bowie story, search Year of the Bowie. For the Neil Young story, search Year of the Neil. For the Joni Mitchell story, search Year of the Joni. And for the Stevie Wonder story, search Year of the Stevie. All four seasons are available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also check out my monthly podcast called BDWPS Podcast, where I play some of my favorite new music coming from the underground. If you are interested in exploring any of the interviews, songs, or research materials used in this episode, a works cited list can be found at bdwps.com. Also, remember to follow us at BDWPS on Twitter and Instagram for the latest podcast news. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in a month.